It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
Here we are, episode 20 of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Can you believe it's been 20 shows already?
And it seems like just yesterday.
Exactly. So we are going to do James Bond.
Yeah, there is a lot of information. When we started doing the research for James Bond, it was just a wormhole that, you know, it got to be the different Bonds, although there's only really one dead. But the rest of them, it became the villains, it became the girls, and the girls are some of the girls are villains and some of them on it. So you'd call, you know, Grace Jones a Bond girl, you really can't because she was not a love interest. I know, it's confusing. So what Mike and I did was choose who we thought were most interesting. So this is by no means a encyclopedic, you know, rundown of every Bond and every movie and every person, but the people we thought sort of like the greatest hits, the most interesting of the stories.
Right, exactly. So this will be fun. James Bond is a personal favorite of mine growing up. Who is your favorite James Bond?
Roger Moore.
You're right. Me too. Isn't that funny? Most people will say Sean Connery, but that's kind of funny. We're both Roger Moore fans.
See, he was the Bond I grew up with, though. He was the one, you know, Connery, he was the first few movies, but Roger Moore took over and he was the one I grew up with. So when I saw kids, you know, Saturday matinees, it was him first. I like Sean Connery, but to me, I don't know, more of a fair-haired Bond for some reason that I like that more. So, it's interesting because I was looking at a couple of the different choices for the different Bonds over the, you know, Ian Fleming supposedly wanted David Niven originally. But did you see, something popped up the other day. They do one of those deep fake things, you know, where they computer generate other faces on actors. And they did a Burt Reynolds, Sean Connery James Bond one, and it's so good, and it's so scary because you realize you just don't need actors anymore. You know, it's what's so sad about. I mean, they can resurrect Burt Reynolds, like they're talking about doing James Dean now for whatever. You know, they're going to. It's frightening because these people died and they don't have any say so of what's going on with their careers. You know, it was like when Fred Astaire was selling, selling vacuum cleaners or something?
Something like that.
And it was just I find that so. I like seeing him again. However, it's just so, I think it's almost like grave robbing in a weird way. And
yeah, there's an ethical question around it for sure. Cause they're not there to say, oh, that's how I would have done that.
Yes. And that's why I had a problem with Natalie Cole, you know, doing the duets with her father. It's like her father, you know, didn't say yes to that.
Right.
And Natalie Cole basically, you know, I like the music. I'm not going to say I don't, but to me, it's crossed a line a bit of permissions and rights. Hey, whatever, man. It's the family's wishes. Whoever has the rights to these images, they're probably getting a lot of money for this stuff.
Speaking of the family's wishes, did I tell you that I came across a weird... Oh, I think I sent you the chapter. I was reading Dean Torrance's book, Dean Torrance of Jan and Dean, the surf rock duo of the 60s. He has a book called Surf City, the Jan and Dean Story, which is like an autobiography, basically. And... if you can believe it, Dean Torrance of Jan and Dean had a Manson story.
I know you sent it to me, but I didn't get a chance to read it, so I'm sorry.
I'll tell it to you.
Okay, please do.
It's hilarious. Well, it's weird. He never actually, I don't think, ever met the Mansons, but he was connected to them through the Beach Boys because they were all friends. And Brian Wilson wrote Jan and Dean songs. Brian Wilson co-wrote Dead Man's Curve for Jan and Dean and some other songs. And Dean was also friends with Dennis Wilson. And so he knew of this like hippie dude coming around wanting to be a rock star. And that Dennis Wilson was trying to help him out and was trying to get Terry Melcher involved. And Terry Melcher also knew Dean. And so I guess what happened was after the Mansons, you know, were kicked out of Dennis Wilson's house and moved to Spahn Ranch, Dennis Wilson, you know, was still going out there to visit them, and he was trying to get Terry Melcher to go out and hear Manson perform. And this is when Dean gets involved. So Dean Torrance claims that he was good friends with this very successful session guitarist who had made a mobile recording studio out of an Airstream trailer. And so Terry Melcher calls Dean up one day and says, "Hey, man, I'm supposed to go out to this, you know, this movie ranch out in the middle of nowhere to some hippie commune, and I really don't want to. I'd rather just have send someone out to record these guys, and then I'll just listen to the recording. Do you know anybody that could go do that? And Dean's like, oh, yeah, I have a good friend of mine just built a mobile recording studio. He'll do it. So anyway, so this guy agreed to do it, and he went out, and he came back, and Dean was supposed to go with him out to Spahn Ranch that weekend. And then Dean was dating some girl that lived in Malibu, and she invited him out for the weekend, and he just totally forgot about this whole hippie thing and went and spent the weekend with her, and then remembered, you know, the next Monday, like, oh, crap, I was supposed to go do that. So he checks in with this guy, and this guy's like, oh, man, it was so amazing. There are all these girls around, and we had, like, an orgy, and we just, like, hung out. And Dean was like, okay, well, how'd the recording come out? And he's like, oh, we didn't really get to that. So he's like, I'm supposed to go out again next weekend and actually do the recording. And so he goes out the next weekend. And again, Dean kind of stood the guy up and got distracted and didn't go with him. And he said that he checked in with the guy afterwards, and the guy didn't want to talk about it the second trip. He's like, I don't want to talk about it. And so Dean called a mutual friend of theirs, and the friend said, oh, yeah, Manson got really mad at him and held a pitchfork to his throat and threatened to kill him. And the girls had to intervene to keep Charlie from doing it. And so he'll never go out there and work with those, deal with those people again. And then, you know, a few months later is when the murders happened. So anyways, I thought it was interesting that like clean cut Jan and Dean even had connections in some weird way to the Manson story.
It is weird.
But that Surf City, the Jan and Dean story, is a pretty good book. It's on Amazon. I recommend it.
Cool. Yeah. It's couple of songs that Jan and Dean did, I was sort of surprised that it wasn't the Beach Boys, you know?
Right.
Because I didn't know that Brian Wilson co-wrote Dead Man's Curve. I didn't know that.
Yep. They wrote it at Brian Wilson's mom's house in Santa Monica.
Audrey, the mother, she's buried at Westwood in the original Surfer Girl, it says on her grave.
Oh, how nice. That's awesome.
But it's fascinating, that stuff, how far-reaching it all is. It's, I mean, obviously, we know how how fascinating it is to us.
And there was one other thing I wanted to point out. You know, our last show was on Different Strokes, and we also mentioned The Exorcist. And what we didn't mention was Dana Plato was originally cast as the lead in The Exorcist.
She was supposed to play the role
that Linda Blair got. I've double confirmed this, and Dana Plato ended up being in the sequel, The Exorcist 2, and has a scene with Linda Blair.
How old was she when The Exorcist was made?
She was only like 9 or 10. So she was four years younger than Linda Blair, which is interesting because Linda Blair was like 13, 14, I think, when she made that. So it would have totally changed, I think, the character quite a bit, having her that much younger. Apparently, Dana Plato's mom was the one that said no to it, that she had the part, and their mom's like, nope. And then, you know, 4 years later, when they make The Exorcist 2, Dana Plato had a small part in it as she was like a developmentally disabled girl. And she has a scene with Linda Blair. It's kind of interesting. So, and then, you know, a year after Exorcist 2 came out, Different Strokes happened. So, you know, she got her break.
Interesting. And Max von Sydow, who just died recently, was one of the Bond villains, which I think is kind of interesting.
You know, so incestuous.
It all comes together, these actors. You know, before we get going, I want to shout out one of the people that listened to us. His name is Charles Fritz. I haven't read it yet, but he sent me the book about the elephant, the Edison elephant.
Oh, Topsy.
Yeah. I'm not. So he just sent it to me, and I'm anxious to get started on it.
That was the electrocuted elephant?
Yeah. And apparently there's several stories in here about Edison and animals, et cetera. So I'm anxious to get started. So I just want to say thanks to Charles for sending this to me. I'm looking forward to that.
That's a thick book, too. It's like a lot of stories in there. Huh.
Yeah. The startling story of the crooked-tailed elephant, P.T. Barnum and the American wizard, Thomas Edison. So they probably knew each other and were in cahoots some level. They all are.
Right.
Pretty interesting. So thanks, Charles. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Charles. That's cool. All right, why not? Let's just do hate mail.
Hate mail.
tons of nice mail, tons and tons and tons. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really, it's a lot of supportive email. And I can't say I got anything necessarily negative regarding the podcast, but I did have a guy wrote me and he says, you can technically file this under hate mail because I hate that I end up Googling Gary Coleman's penis after listening to the show.
It's one of those things. Once you put the idea in someone's head, they can't get over it.
I got to look.
We had a nice note from one of our Patreon supporters, which is a plug. We are on Patreon, which you can join for little as $2 a month, and you get advanced access to these episodes. They come out a couple day or two ahead of time on Patreon, and we also do mini episodes every month, which are like in between these main shows. But Patreon mm-hmm. supporter Don wrote, we were talking about the members of death cults that are still around that survived and are still doing things. Don writes, just to let you know, there are still Branch Davidians on the Mount Carmel property in Waco. It's the creepiest place I've ever been. You may still have the artifacts that I sent you from that property. I don't know.
You got something? Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
He said,
Donnie. Hi, Donnie. Yeah.
He said the survivors cleared the remains of the church compound that we all knew and rebuilt a small church on the property. When you pull onto the property, there are different creepy memorials for all the children, adults, and officers that died that day.
Wow. Yeah, Don went there and he found all kinds of – there's like the bus is still there. And that is fascinating. I went through that area of Texas, but we just didn't bother. And I don't know why to stop at Waco, but that's interesting. Yeah, it's wild to think that those people are still around. You know, the source is still around. The Children of God, which is that, the Phoenix family is involved with, they're still around. And who is that guy? The guy from Fleetwood Mac that that left to get a newspaper and joined the cult, and they couldn't find him for months.
As you do, right?
So, it's fascinating.
Well, there's still Heaven's Gate people around, I think, the people that were left behind to keep the site running.
Well, you think that didn't work out, you know? you missed the comet. it's going to be another 1,000 years before it shows up again. But
imagine being disappointed that you missed out on that.
Yeah, yeah.
We did get one critical review on iTunes. The person just said we dropped too many names.
Okay.
That's what we do, though. That's the show.
That's so, okay. I mean, you know,
I respect everyone's opinion, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. But thanks for listening.
Exactly. Thanks for listening. any more mail?
Because there's going to be a lot of name dropping in this one. So just forewarn you, if you don't like this stuff, just turn off the volume, but keep it going.
Is that all the mail?
I think so. Yeah. Just a ton of supportive mail. And the only there's a few Gary Colemans, but that was the best.
Shall we do Deaths of the Week?
Sure.
News of the Week.
I think it probably has to start with Brian Dennehy, winner of two Tony Awards, 6 Emmys, a Golden Globe. He was in Ratatouille and Tommy Boy, both movies where he played the dad of the main character. He was in two of my favorites from 1985, Cocoon and Silverado. One of my Silverado for sure is in my like top 20. And he was in the FX movies and a bunch of others. They said he liked to be in movies and TV shows because it supported his stage acting career, which is where he really loved.
I used to really like him as just a nice, likable character. But when he played Gacy, that was the one where, like, that changed it for me because he was so good at being, you know, there was a point where Gacy, you know, was a clown. Mm-hmm. And then the little kid came up to him and he just switched modes and it became this really awful, you know, kid, get away from me kind of thing. But it was so, so scary. But you know what? One thing that nobody really touched on in any of the obituaries, and I'm looking it up right now just to be absolutely sure, and that Dennehy, it sounds really terrible, but Dennehy falsely claimed to be a veteran. And that was a big deal back.
I didn't know it was a false claim, was it?
Yeah, yeah, it was, because there was outrage. And let's see, Brian Dennehy claimed for years that he served a 5-year tour as a Marine in Vietnam, where he was wounded. In reality, Dennehy's only Vietnam action was on screen in Rumor of War, in which he portrayed a Marine gunnery side sergeant. So he did serve in the Marines. It was not in Vietnam. And his only combat duty was playing football in Okinawa in 62.
Wow.
So that was scandalous back when it first happened. And you know, it tarnished his career, but not a single person mentioned it after he died.
I just knew he was a Marine veteran. I didn't know there was a scandal around that he claimed to be in combat. That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I liked him outside of that. He was just this big burly guy who could play a menacing bad guy but also be really charismatic at the same time. There's not just kind of nobody else that can do what Brian Dennehy did, right? He was one of those kinds of actors.
Yeah, likable and easily not likable.
Right.
You know? Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a lot of, people don't have that arc.
So he died on April 15th, cardiac arrest due to sepsis, and he was 81 years old. And then I think next up really is John Prine, the folk singer, songwriter. I was not that familiar with him before he died, but I know he was very, very famous and highly respected. He was a musician's musician, I think. And there's a great story about how Roger Ebert launched his career in 1970. Ebert was supposed to be at a movie screening to review it, and he left early because the popcorn was too salty, according to him. And so he walked over to a nearby bar just to get a beer, and there was a guy playing folk music, and it was John Prine. And Ebert wrote later on, "Through no wisdom of my own, but out of sheer blind luck, I walked into the Fifth Peg, a folk club on West Armitage Street, one night in 1970, and heard a mailman from Westchester singing." And Ebert wrote the article based on that performance that launched John Prine's career.
Interesting. Interesting. But yeah, likable, very well respected for sure. And it's a real shame that he's gone.
Yeah, he was covered and championed by Bonnie Raitt, Dylan, Springsteen, Mellencamp, REM. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. He was a contemporary of Kris Kristofferson. And there's a great interview online of him with Bill Murray, who I believe he was really good friends with as well. Bill Murray was a fan of his going way back. So, and John Prine and Brian Dennehy, both Chicago connections. Prine was from Chicago, and Dennehy was real big on the stage in Chicago. So.
That's right. I saw him in Chicago. I forgot about that. He was making... Yeah, anyway, yeah. I think I remember he was a native Chicagoan.
You saw John Prine or Dennehy?
Dennehy. I remember seeing him walking down... Chicago. I mean, that sounds like I'm name dropping. But no. I remember it was Chicago, and I remember seeing him walking around and while he was doing... No, he wasn't even filming. So anyway, that doesn't matter. I mean, you know. Yeah, I saw someone. No, it was just conversationally. I didn't intend to do that.
So... Prine passed away on April 7th at the age of 73, and it was from the coronavirus. And it was sad because it was covered in the press when he went on. He was in, intensive care, and he was on the ventilator. And it kind of sounded like maybe he was starting to do better, and then he passed away. So rest in peace, John Prine. Malcolm Dixon, who is a British actor with dwarfism. He was 4'1", and he was most famous as Leek Tar, the Ewok in Return of the Jedi, and as Strutter in Time Bandits. And he was in a bunch of other movies where they needed little people. So he played an Oompa Loompa in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. He appeared in the Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Willow, and he passed away. He was in a bunch of sometimes uncredited roles. They just needed, a group of little people like Oompa Loompas. He had a really fascinating long career, and he passed away on April 9th at 86, and no cause was given.
Wow. My little friend Sadie from Rocky Horror, she worked a lot, as a little person. I think we might have talked about her before, but she played the slave master in the Dark Crystal and the person in the costume, and she was an Ewok too. So they must have known each other. She knew Kenny Baker, so she must have known these guys.
Who was R2-D2, right?
Yeah.
Honor Blackman. coincidentally, since we're talking about Bond, famous, probably most famous for being Pussy Galore, the Bond girl in Goldfinger, which has got to be one of the best character names in history. Pussy Galore.
Pussy Galore in the Goldfinger.
She liked, I guess she liked to make people uncomfortable back then, like pseudo executives, by, you know, introducing herself as Pussy Galore and seeing, you know, the expression on their face. And then what is it with Bond and that name? Because there was also Octopussy, which is one of my favorite Roger Moore ones.
I don't understand how they, it was the most bizarre thing to see that on movie marquees. And it's like, how do you clear that with censors? You know what I mean? They won't. It's just, okay, that they let that one go. I don't.
It can also be a cat. I know that's what they probably said, right? I don't know. It's like, weren't you saying that when in documentaries, the thing about it, you could say the word fuck?
As a curse word, not as an action.
It's all about context. So there you go. She was also famous as Kathy Gale in The Avengers and as Hera in Jason and the Argonauts, both 60s series. And it's funny, if you watch where she gets introduced as Pussy Galore in Goldfinger, it's very, very, very similar to the introduction of Grace Kelly in Rear Window, where James Bond is asleep and he wakes up and we go to his POV and there's this blurry image of Blackman coming in towards the screen, you know, her face coming towards the camera. So I thought that was kind of interesting that it was it was very clearly, you know, based on that. But she passed away on April 5th from natural causes. She was 94, and her family was very adamant to make sure people knew that it wasn't coronavirus related, which is just the times we live in.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in the 60s, she released a single called Kinky Boots. Because she was famous for, you know, wearing these like stiletto boots, you know, in the show, and it was a pop song that was really successful in Britain, and then they took that you know title for the play Kinky Boots, and
interesting.
So it was Honor Blackman's single.
And oh wow!
It's such a weird song, you know. Then it had a kinky boots. It's just weird, but in Britain that's what they call them. They do call them kinky boots when you know you're the stiletto, you know. Like big boots. Yeah,
sure.
They do call them that. So, as a nickname, it's kind of funny. Not funny, it just is.
It's and then something definitely not funny, RFK, Robert F. Kennedy's granddaughter, Maeve McKean, and her son Gideon drowned. She was 40 and her son was only 8. They took a canoe supposedly into a cove of the Chesapeake Bay just to retrieve a lost ball, and the wind and the waves were too much and carried them away, and they drowned back on April 2nd.
It's horrible. Did they go out without a paddle?
I don't know what the whole. I haven't read the whole thing on what happened. Just that the wind and the waves were too much. That would, I don't know.
People are saying it was fairly not wise. To
right.
Do what she did,
to take a canoe out into the Chesapeake Bay, but I guess they were in a little cove that they thought was sheltered, and somehow.
Oh yeah, and it was just there's the ball. I can see it. Let's go grab it.
Let's just go
and
get
somehow,
it.
And somehow it's just they didn't find the little boy for a couple of days after finding her.
Yeah.
And it's just you know, people will always say the Kennedy curse, and some might just say it's. You know, like JFK, it was human error. It was a dumb thing to do. I mean, I'm sorry, but it was stupid. And
flew into conditions he wasn't rated to fly in. Flew into a foggy day and crashed. Yeah.
So there were dumb mistakes.
And which was who was the one that died skiing, playing like football while skiing?
Michael Kennedy. Yeah. Or was it? It was skiing. He wasn't playing football, was he? On skis?
They were like playing catch, I think, or something like that. And he was kind of like skiing backwards or something and went into a tree. I think is how that happened.
Yeah.
Is that the deaths of the month, week? 2 weeks?
Well, I'm sure there are loads more, but I was watching. I just wanted to point out because there was a guy, the guy we mentioned in the last episode, Adam Schlesinger, or Schlesinger, who wrote That Thing You Do. And yesterday, that's like one of my all-time favorite movies. And yesterday, the guys, the Wonders, the four actors, and a couple of the other ones popped in here and there, did a live commentary on YouTube.
Oh,
and it's really cool. And they were raising money for for victims of Corona. And if you, it's on YouTube, and there's a little link for the. It's a Corona in this guy's name, in this guy's memory. Yeah. And I'm sure it's on YouTube to watch. You know, they couldn't watch it because of copyright. They couldn't actually play it. But they said, okay, right about now, hit play.
And, it's like riff tracks.
And it was awesome. It was really cool to sit through it and listen to the stories.
And if you're looking for, I think Colin Hanks tweeted out a link to it as well on his Twitter account.
He was on it through the whole thing.
So there you go.
I didn't realize that he was in the movie and he was an integral part. I mean, he came out with some really good stories.
Colin Hanks is in that movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Who is he in it? It's been so long since I watched it.
Well, he wasn't a featured player. I mean, there was a point where Liv Tyler goes to watch the boys play at CBS, Television City, and he escorts her. And there's a few – he was just an extra and probably an AP or something like that.
Sure.
But he was there for most of it, for some of the editing, for the recording in the studio, and he had great stories about the shoots. And it was just a lot of fun. For someone who likes that movie, you'd really enjoy it. And if you donate, it's to a good cause.
Speaking of
good causes,
you don't like it, stupid.
You're a dumb. Now, another good cause that I will shout out to, because my good friend Jeff Mantor, who owns Larry Edmonds Bookstore in Hollywood. Larry Edmonds is the last independent bookstore in Hollywood on Hollywood Boulevard. It's been around since 1938. He worked, his shop was represented in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and now that his big support for the year is the TCM Festival in Hollywood that usually takes place in that area. With this going on, it just shut everything down. And Jeff is this lone bookstore on Hollywood Boulevard with his gate shut. And rent has gone up. And it just sucks so bad because it's a real, it's a bookstore that sells used books in Hollywood. If you want to go pick up a documentary or a book about, Faye Ray or something like that, that you will find it there. And it's been around, as I said, since 38, and they're suffering big time. And I would just say a shout out. Look up Larry Edmonds Bookstore in Hollywood. And if you can find it in your heart to give them a couple of bucks, it's a good people and institution. And I hope somebody steps up. It'd be got to be sad for film lovers because there's so little left in Hollywood of old Hollywood, and Larry Edmonds does celebrate that. So anyway, that's the last I'll say about it.
I'm going to plug one more thing and then we'll get into our main feature. I just joined a documentary series for the Discovery family on Moto Trends TV, which used to be Velocity. It's a show called Autobiography, and it's a car history show. And so I just joined as a producer, bringing them some episode ideas and developing those out. They already have their first season out, and it's really interesting. Like, they did a Ford versus Ferrari episode, which was the real story behind the movie, which was really interesting. And they did there was a crazy story they did about this buried Ferrari that was buried in a yard in the 70s in South Central LA. Mm-hmm. And it was dug up, and it had been stolen from the Brown Derby on Wilshire. The guy that owned it went to the Brown Derby on a date, went inside, Pello parked it, came out, car was gone. And then turns up a few years later buried in a yard in South LA. So
was there anyone in it?
No, luckily no. That's always the big fear when you find a buried car. There was no body in it. It turned out it really was car thieves, and they stole a car and then realized it was too hot because all the publicity it got. So they
They buried it,
thinking we'll unbury it later when the heat cools off, and then we'll unload it. And then it just didn't happen, and it got discovered. So it's a really fascinating story. So, anyways, Autobiography. It's a really cool show, and I'm glad I'm on it. So
Autobiography, interesting. Yes. Okay, cool. Because there was a lady that was some wacky lady that was buried in her car somewhere. There's a couple of stories like that, that I'm taking it with me kind of thing.
And, I got you.
Yeah.
I mean, there's other stories. Sometimes when you find a buried car, it's foul play. It's like that. It's a body is inside and they buried it. Kind of like the end of Psycho when he ditches the car in the bog with her body in the trunk. That happens a lot. So, yeah, there you go. Autobiography, one word, on Motor Trends TV.
Okay, this is a good one. My friend Donna Lethal is her name, and she just sent me an article, which is pretty fascinating. It's in an article in the British tabloid. I guess you can call it a newspaper, The Guardian. And The Guardian, you know, it's a legitimate news source for a lot of people, and they reference another newspaper called The Sun. And The Sun is just a tabloid. The Sun is just trashy news. But anyway, this references The Sun because there was a lawsuit, because there was a woman in Leeds, in England, who sued The Sun because they outed her because they said that she was in a relationship with a 92-year-old chandelier that she bought on eBay. and she basically is saying she was outed by that. And there's a term for that, people that are in love
with sexuality, I believe.
Is that what it is?
It. Yeah.
Object sexuality.
And there's probably some other more scientific name, but yeah, that's, yeah.
Okay. So they're saying that they outed her and she sued for that. I guess it was some sort of privacy issue. And one of the defense that The Sun used was that she had already admitted to being in love. She changed her name to Liberty because she was in love with the Statue of Liberty. So they were saying, you know, basically, you know, it's your own fault. And the judge said that it does not count as a sexual orientation to be in love with an inanimate object. So because, I mean, there's, you know, there's people, there's all kinds of people that are all in love with things. You know, there was that TLC had like an extreme show. I like the eating one. You know, I love that. Like, and extreme addiction. You know, people eating their sofa and still, I love like dryer sheets. And there was one. I remember there was a guy that was in love with his car, and he literally had a sexual relationship with his car, which is interesting. TLC.
I remember there was a story. I think years ago, a guy was in love with his toaster oven. I want to say. And hopefully he didn't try to have sex with that.
At least not while it was plugged in. Plugged.
Right.
I said plugged.
All right. I feel like we've covered the world so far. Are we ready for the main feature?
We know everything now. Everything.
Everything that's important. Time for the main feature.
Ready?
Jazz hands. Let's do it.
It's time for the main feature.
So we're talking about James Bond.
You got to say it. You got to say it the way it's meant. Bond.
James Bond.
There you are. It's got to be done once.
Shaken, not stirred. there are officially 25 Bond films that are considered, you know, official canon produced by Eon Productions. There's been some that were produced away from them that are not considered official. But the main ones are these 25 films. They star six different actors have been Bond in those 25 films. The most recent one was supposed to have just come out a couple weeks ago. Coincidentally, and that's with Daniel Craig, No Time to Die, directed by Cary Fukunaga, which I was really excited to see because he directed all the episodes in the first season of True Detective with Matthew McConaughey. He was that like genius that, you know, that directed those, that thing. So I was really excited to see what he's done with this, and it's been pushed from April release to November now. And they're talking about it's going to lose like at least $50 million, supposedly. And a lot of movies are because they're everything that's had a theatrical release is disappearing now. And the blockbusters, the studios must be panicking right now over what they're going to do because the summer blockbuster season is going to be almost non-existent, at least in the U.S., which is their biggest market. So,
yeah. And with, I mean, nobody, there's such a spoiled for choice, you know, on every streaming service, that it's going to be difficult to release a feature film premiere on a platform when there's so many other choices. Nobody's going to want to pay for it.
Right.
You know, because they did that Invisible Man that just came out right before all this went down.
With Elizabeth Moss, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they went straight to video on that one, or straight to download, and it was high price. But sure. I wonder what the... You know, if someone's going to pay $15 to download it when they can watch everything else for free or on whatever their subscription is.
I can speak for myself. Like, I would pay $10 or $15 to watch a James Bond in-home streaming in 4K, you know, on my TV. I would do that. I don't know if everybody would do that and how much of a difference. They're taking a huge risk in doing that because then how do you release it theatrically after you've already released it digitally.
And also, you can't control it. Once it's on the internet, you can't control it. And you know, it's going to hit the pirate sites right away.
Right.
And people are going to go, why should I? You know, I don't know. It's just, well, anyway, it's more fallout from all of this. But
yep.
But I'm looking forward to that film, because I've never been a Bond freak. I've never gone, I got to go see this movie. But every time I watch one, I really enjoy it.
They are so fun, and I really like Daniel Craig as James Bond. I'm one of the. Mm-hmm. I was on board with that from when it was first announced. I remember it was controversial. A lot of people weren't in favor of him as Bond, but then he brought like a physicality, action star-ness to it that hadn't really totally existed up to that point. It was very, I think, inspired probably by the Jason Bourne franchise, kind of making him more physical.
And there's always outrage when it comes to change, always. Because there was talk of Idris
Elba.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then there was talk of a female Bond. There was talk about really fairly recently, which, of course, you know, the internet went crazy. So, you know, because people just don't like change. And those are pretty major changes to something that people have been familiar with for over 50 years. So I can understand how people would be uncomfortable with change.
However, have an idea of that's the last of their entire life of what James Bond is. So don't mess with that. Right.
Right. It's a different generation, though, because the original James Bond generation is, you know, if they're not dead yet, they're on their way out. And, you know, you know what I'm saying? They're an older generation, and that generation is leaving. And we, you know, or me, I'll be the next generation heading into that area. But, you know, I remember when those movies came out, and, you know, but the stars of them are, you know, dwindling. So,
Said at the beginning of this, you know, we could talk for 6 hours about this subject if we really wanted to dive into it. So we have to focus on the things that are interesting to us, right?
Yeah.
So where do you want to start?
Well, the logical point would be Ian Fleming, because he wrote, you know, he started the with the books,
with the
short stories, and ultimately, you know, somebody said, hey, let's make a movie out of this.
And he had said when he wrote the books, he pictured David Niven.
Yeah, yeah.
As the character.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, which would have been, you know, elegant enough, but sure. David Niven wasn't an athletic man, and there had to be, you know, he had to be built. He had to be a sexy guy that people really desired, and David Niven, I don't think, was that guy. He was a gentleman, but he wasn't a sexual attraction or an attractive man. He was a good-looking guy, but he was, you know, aristocratic rather than, you know, somebody that...
When they went to make the movies, they were like, no, we're going to have sexy guys. We're not going to have kind of reserved gentlemanly types like David Niven, I guess. We need a guy that can take his shirt off.
Right. That's what they were thinking. I've never saw him Niven without a shirt on, so I can't say... You know, I could see where the other guys, and you know, Roger Moore was sort of that Niven type too.
Absolutely.
But then Roger Moore was built, you know, and Niven was not a classically good-looking guy. You know, he was handsome in his own way, but
and,
he's not the guy.
And Roger Moore was like the leisure suit Bond in that era. Right. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Those were like Barbie dolls for. You know, every you know, here's him skiing. Here's him scuba diving, you know. I think that maybe G.I. Joe riffed on those things, or Action Man riffed on those things where, you know, because with the success of G.I. Joe and all these, because I remember G.I. Joe had all kinds of weird little get-ups, astronaut G.I. Joe. And so it would make sense that that they were, and Matchbox hit into it, you know, because the Goldfinger, Aston Martin? Was that? I think Goldfinger, or was it a?
Yeah, he had his famous for an Aston Martin DB5, the silver car that they've brought back for some of the newer Bond films as well as a throwback. Yeah, the famous Aston Martin, which those go for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars now if you can find one of those old Aston Martins.
And that's one of the top ever Matchbox toys, you know, little toy cars. And I remember my neighbor had one of those. They had little guns that came out you know, little gadgets that were stuck on it. And those were, you know, the 60s were great, man.
Mel Blanc's big car wreck where he almost died was in an Aston Martin, a precursor to the DB5.
Oh, it's funny because I was going to mention that accident today because he's Dead Man's Curve.
That's Dead Man's Curve. That's what inspired the whole thing. Yep.
Yeah. A lot of people think.
He ran into someone came across the line. A college kid came over in a big American Oldsmobile and just crushed his little British Aston Martin. And he broke almost every major bone in his body and shouldn't have survived, but he did.
And famously did his voice of Barney Rubble from the hospital bed.
He did like 40 episodes from his bed, yeah.
Because there's three Dead Man's Curves in Los Angeles. There's the one that he was almost killed on, which is in front of UCLA. Mm-hmm. There's the one that a lot of people think it is, which is that S curve over just by the entrance of Bel Air. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the other one is Whittier Drive, where Jan Berry had his near fatal accident right off of Sunset. So, but that's the real one. The one that they wrote that inspired the song was the Mel Blanc one by UCLA. Mm-hmm. So back to Fleming. So Fleming, he was military. What's fascinating about this is there are real spy stories in this. You know, like we talked about Pussy Galore. Pussy Galore was a real spy, and Fleming was involved with that. And the guy that did all the gadgets was a Q that did the gadgets, he was involved with spy work and gadgets, and they would MI6. Which is the British CIA, they would exchange information about certain gadgets. And he would say, we have an idea for this, but this is going to mess up with anything you're doing over there. but it was all the, he came up with, the pen cameras and there was a lot of legitimacy to a lot of those gadgets. And they're really cool. They're really clever. But Ian Fleming himself was military, and Ian Fleming actually has an airport named after him, which is kind of funny, in Jamaica. But he lived there, right? I think so. Yeah. It's not where he died, but it is where he lived for sure. And it's funny to say he was. He had a heart attack, and while he was in his hospital bed, they told him to. Consider writing a bedtime story or something like that for his kids, and he wrote Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
No kidding.
Yeah. Ian Fleming is the author of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Holy cow!
I know, right? And the thing about Chitty Bang Bang, Chitty Chitty had all the gadgets in the car. And all that sort of business, much like the Bond stuff. And also the movie was produced by Cubby Broccoli, who, produced all the Bond films.
Right.
So it's just a fascinating, a lot of people don't put that connection together. And the guy that played the King in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang also was one of the guys that played one of the Bond villains, too. Which is, I know, it's fascinating. So the Connery movies were Russia with Love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, Diamonds Are Forever, and I think those were the ones. And then Connery didn't want to do it anymore, and he was afraid of being typecast, so that's when they went with Roger Moore, who was originally considered, but Roger Moore was involved with another show and couldn't free himself up.
And I think in the middle there was Lazenby, right?
That's right. You're right. 69 was on Her Majesty's Secret Service. That was George Lazenby, right?
I have a George Lazenby story.
Yeah?
I have a couple, actually. So George Lazenby is famous because he's the only person who had played Bond only once in the official 25 movies. And there's a really great documentary that came out a couple years ago, and I believe it's still on Hulu, and it is called Becoming Bond. And it is a really well-made documentary all about his experience, his life, and then how he became Bond and how basically how he blew it. He famously blew this amazing opportunity because they wanted him to keep coming back and do more James Bonds, and he just got real full of himself. He was the youngest person to ever play Bond. He was only 29, and I think he showed up at the world premiere like in a beard with like his hair kind of grown out, like he was like he was in the Beatles, and they were like, "What are you doing? You're supposed to be James Bond." And he just got this attitude of, "I'm too good for this now. I've got 18 other offers on the table now. I can do anything I want." Kind of a guy. I don't want to be this puppet, being told what to do in this James Bond character and controlled. And his acting career never ever recovered after that. And it's really fascinating. I came across him years ago. I was working for this martial arts TV network, and we put on this B-movie called Death Dimension. which was an action, a martial arts action movie, and he played the police captain. And this was, you know, almost a decade after he was James Bond, and here he is playing, you know, police captain in this very forgettable action thing. And then the other thing is, when I lived in Santa Monica, he apparently lived nearby, and there was a restaurant that I frequented there that he apparently was known to hang out in. So he was across the street at this bar, and his movie was playing at the theater across the street on His Majesty's Secret Service. And everybody in the bar is telling him, hey, you should go over there and say hi to everybody. And he's like, nah, I don't need that. You know, I'm over the Bond thing, whatever. Well, apparently somebody told the audience across the street in the theater that, hey, George Lazenby's across the street right now. And when the movie came out, everybody in the theater came into this restaurant. And he ended up having a great time posing for photos and, you know, got to be the toast of the night. But he kind of, he's an old man now, but he kind of looks like an old Cary Grant. You know, he's still kind of got the looks, I guess, in his old age, and is, you know, I guess, content with his life. But I really recommend Becoming Bond on Hulu. It's really, really an interesting piece of Hollywood history, movie history. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a documentary in the Bond Girls too. This is such a crazy franchise, because it just branches out into 20 different ways, and you know, you could have a James Bond, I'm sure there's a James Bond weapons documentary, the cars of James Bond, you know, right. the girls, the villains. I'm sure there's you know, things devoted to all of these, certainly on the internet, but it's hard to whittle down. But Roger Moore, Live and Let Die, Man with the Golden Gun, The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, and A View to a Kill. Which a lot of those, I mean, Spy Who Loved Me and A View to a Kill, I mean, classic songs involved with that, you know.
What's your favorite Bond song?
Oh, 100,000 times Goldfinger.
Goldfinger! Like,
yeah. Shirley Bassey is, you know, she's from Wales, and she call her, the nickname is Leather Lungs, because that woman could belt. And she did, you know, Hey Big Spender, and she did another Bond thing. I'll think of it in a second. Do you remember a couple of years ago on the Academy Awards, they had a 50th anniversary of James Bond. I think it was 50. And it was going to be a big deal, because all the Bonds were going to be out on stage, and Shirley Bassey was going to come out and sing Goldfinger. And it was so exciting, but it turns out Connery, as I understand it, isn't doing great, and he couldn't show up. And without him, what's the point, you know?
Right.
So doing this whole reunion. So it was a big tribute to James Bond, and Shirley Bassey came out, and she killed it. I mean, she was spectacular, as she always does. But it just didn't have the oomph if all the actors would have been there. And I do think it was because of the Connery isn't doing terrific. But Shirley Bassey, Goldfinger by far. What about yourself?
You Only Live Twice, Nancy Sinatra. I love that song. And John Barry, you know, who composed the famous James Bond scores, he composed the song. And I guess supposedly they wanted Frank to do it. He said no, so Nancy did it. And I read an account that she was very nervous to record it, and it took 25 different takes for them to stitch the song together, because she was so nervous. But I love that song, and second for me would probably be Live and Let Die.
Yeah. No, those are great. Paul McCartney, man, and that's like two songs in there. You know, there's like three songs in that song. You know, it just switches mode so many times.
Right.
The other one, Carly Simon, you know, nobody does it better. She did... The Spy Who Loved Me, and also Sheena Easton did For Your Eyes Only. View to a Kill was Duran Duran. Diamonds Are Forever, that was the other one Shirley Bassey did. Live and Let Die's Paul McCartney. Who Spy Who Loved Me? And what else? Didn't Sheena Easton do another one?
Let's not forget the Madonna classic.
No, does that even exist?
I hope it's been like lost. I hope it's been buried in the desert somewhere.
Isn't Nobody Does It Better? Isn't that a Bond song?
Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. It's in the opening credits of one of the songs.
Nobody Does It Better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was from A Spy Who Loved Me. That's right. And so she must have done. Sorry, just screw what I just said. So The Spy Who Loved Me. I keep thinking it was It was two songs that she did, but no, it was one song she did, and that was Nobody Does It Better, and that was the theme. Yeah. So, but she, I mean, she's great. I love Carly Simon too, but
And Nobody Does It Better is karaoke sung very poorly at the hotel bar by Anna Faris in Lost in Translation, and she sings this very off key version of the song, and Scarlett Johansson and Bill Murray laugh at how bad it is, and move on, and supposedly the Anna Faris character is based on Cameron Diaz in that movie.
Didn't you do karaoke in a movie, Cameron Diaz, really shitty?
Yeah, My Best Friend's Wedding.
Okay.
She gets kind of thinking that Julia Roberts makes her do it, thinking that she'll be horrible and it'll hurt her with her fiance, and it ends up being adorable how bad she is, and ends up backfiring on Julia Roberts. Yeah, that's how I remember it anyways.
Okay.
Anyways, well, James Bond.
Oh, wait, no, wait, hang on one second. So I got to go. When I was doing my research, you just mentioned that the Bond theme was written by
John Barry.
That's a conflict, because there's another guy named Marty Norman who claims to have written it. And there was a lawsuit about this.
Oh, really?
Because because Marty Norman, and I think they actually gave Monty Norman the credit for it. I think that John Barry wrote the original bit, but they ended up using one of his songs in the movie and recommissioning the theme. And this guy Monty Norman, who's still alive, he's 92 years old.
Wow.
Cubby Broccoli composed. So he's the one that did the dang dang
dang. Right, the famous tune.
Yeah. So you know, every success, you know, Richard O'Brien said that success has many fathers, but failure is always an orphan.
Exactly. And, I also got to say, I really liked the Adele song. I thought that's one of the best Bonds, because it was done in a classic 60s orchestration. I felt it had that 60s vibe to it.
I miss when songs like that, you know, were on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing, you know, there's no real, I don't say pop music, but I mean, you know, there's things like that just don't get airplay, and
jazz orchestrations behind them, and you don't see that much.
So back to Roger Moore. So I do have a spectacular Roger Moore story. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, this is like one of the
best.
Can't
wait.
And name dropping, you know. Okay.
Do it. So carpet bomb his name all over the show.
I had dinner with Roger Moore once. And
what?
He ended up where he was on a TV show, and I was in the green room because I knew the host. And after the show was over with, he made it very uncomfortable if we refused to go to have dinner with him. So it was sort of like, oh, I insist. Kind of a thing. So after the show was taped, we went, you know, not very far away to a restaurant, and it was he and his last wife, Kiki, and two or three of his children, I think two of his children. And during dinner, it was the weirdest thing, because we sat down, my ex and I, and not shortly after we sat down, he had this thing in his hand, and he was going like this, and everyone was cracking up on the table. And, you know, we're just looking at each other, my ex and I, like, you know, what the hell's going on? And these guys are, like, red-faced, laughing really, really hard. So finally, Kiki leans over, and behind my ex is a fart machine. So they put it in the middle of the table, and Roger Moore is clicking, and this thing is farting, making fart sounds. And these guys are just dying, laughing. We're just looking at each other like, you know, of course you have to laugh because it's Roger Moore. And it was just a really weird experience. And his daughter was really sweet. His daughter, you could tell that there's a lot of weird tension between the two of them, too, because she lived here, I guess. And she said she was at the gym in West Hollywood. And I got this real impression that she was trying really hard to please him. And she says, oh, Daddy, when I was in the gym one time, the front of the gym, the door just turned black. And I looked, and Arnold Schwarzenegger walked in the room. And that was the end of the story. And Roger Moore's like...
And then what happened?
Anyway. And he just, it was such a horrible, horrible, uncomfortable pause. And it was just like, it was almost intentional. It had to have been. And it was really uncomfortable. But it ended up after we ate, there was we ordered coffees. And the waiter came over and he's got the cappuccino. I ordered a cappuccino and he fell over and he threw it on me. And it was a phony cappuccino that Roger Moore had brought to the restaurant. So it was, honest to God, it was surreal. But yeah, that was Roger Moore and the Fart Machine is one of my favorite celebrity encounters. And being a fake cappuccino being thrown on me, courtesy of Roger Moore, was pretty cool.
So he was a prankster. He was a prankster then. Kind of like yeah. George Clooney and Brad Pitt are both known for being pranksters.
Probably
like
better pranks. You don't buy him at a joke shop.
But more elaborate.
You get him out of the back of magazines. You know, send for the fart machine.
But yeah, here, buy the fake poop. Right? The fake dog poop.
Basically, yeah. Basically. So Roger Moore, he had bouts with illness. He had prostate cancer, and he had, a severe issue with kidney stones, and he had been very ill. Actually, he was married, I think, four times, and his first wives, he was very public about saying they were abusive to him. One he said that, she took a guitar and threw it over his head. The other one was throwing bricks at him. And so he was pretty, adamant about that. It's well researched. And he said, he had a real problem with that. His last wife was Kiki, or Christina, I think is what they called her. But he referred to her as Kiki, that they had a very sane relationship. And Roger Moore at the end was living in Switzerland, I think it was. And that is where he ended up passing away of a heart attack. And
I read he died from prostate cancer.
Well, he had prostate cancer. I know that. Mm. But I don't think
the actual final thing was may have been a heart attack. Yeah, he died on May 23rd, 2017. He was 89 years old.
And he
was Sir Roger Moore. Technically.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he did. He was knighted. In fact, Michael Caine told a story in his book about Roger Moore. Michael Caine said he was walking down the road with Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones, and his phone rang, and he's talking, and he's talking about the royal family or the Queen or something like that. Michael Caine said, Charlie Watts, after he hangs up saying, "Who was that?" He said, "Well, that was Roger Moore. He's on his way to Buckingham Palace, and he's going to be knighted. And he's afraid when he kneels down, he's got bad knees. He's afraid that the Queen's going to have to help, pull him up again." But Charlie Watts, for some reason, knew that there's a railing there, and they taking into consideration someone who might be a bit older will be able to use it to get himself up.
How interesting!
Yeah, yeah.
He should have brought his fart machine.
Right, a little air propulsion. But I've got Donna Lethal to help me find that little bit of information, because that's a great little story.
Wow.
And again, well-liked by most people. I mean, he said he had a drinking problem. He said he was a really unpleasant person, especially to his kids. He was largely, vacant or not around at the time they were growing up, their younger years. So yeah, it's sad. He was in Spice World, too.
Why not?
Yeah, it does have his cause of death. You're right, it's prostate cancer.
Ultimately, how could you say no to Spice World?
There are a lot of good people in that. Meatloaf was in that, and there were some good stars.
I love you say there's really good people in that, and then Meatloaf is the first example.
I go to Rocky Horror all the time because Richard O'Brien was in it, and but Spice World, I like that kind of stuff. I was living there when the Spice Girls were huge, and so I'm fond of that sort of time period. I kind of like them. And I would pay to see them. If they came around, I would absolutely pay. I would buy a ticket to see the Spice Girls, no doubt.
Yep. Hey, by the way, did you go to the Madonna concert?
Oh, that's a bad
I can't remember.
Story.
Did we talk about, did we wrap that? Because I remember we talked about you were mad about it because the time change. Mad.
Yeah, no, I got
Did you end up
got,
going to it, though?
No, it bit me in the ass. I don't
you
know
sold
if I,
them?
I got ripped off.
Oh, no.
$1,800. $1,800, man.
Gosh.
I got ripped off. I am such a dolt. I am a trusting person, and I got screwed over. Long story, very awful. That one hurt big time.
So while we're on the subject, if you guys want to go to our Patreon and help Scott out.
Oh, man, $1,800. Oh, that hurt, man. That hurt.
We need to play some like Sarah McLachlan in the background here so people have their heartstrings pulled and 1800.
Oh my God. Well, you ain't gonna play Madonna. Oh, have you God, have you watched her Instagram things? She's got her lockdown videos. Really? You know, she is in her own Madonna land. And
I don't want to hear from any rich person and what their lockdown is like.
Cause she was in her bathtub, and I think her roses floating with her.
Of course.
She's like, you know, this is the great equalizer. You know, the coronavirus. It's like, you know, so she does these really well lit, you know, pretends to be typing her diaries. And did you ever see Medusa with Julie Brown when that was a send up of Madonna? And it was great because Madonna did her Truth or Dare, and Julie Brown, the comic, did a Medusa, and she resurrected the character recently on Instagram to sort of poke fun at Madonna, who deserves it because she is outrageous. So Ian Fleming, he wrote Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, as I mentioned, and it wasn't published until 2 months after his death, which is, you know, so he didn't live around to see the book being released or the film coming out. But
amazing. He missed all the franchise of his own creation.
That's true. Yeah. And I wonder how much of the estate goes to the family, you know, because most of it probably goes to, you know, Cubby Broccoli's family, who produced most of the films, who made his money in broccoli, really, literally selling broccoli. And truly. And so anyway, Fleming himself died in 12th of August, 1964. He was 56 years old. Now, interesting story about him. His last words, he was in the ambulance from a heart attack going to the hospital. And this is so very British. He said to the ambulance drivers, he says, "I'm so sorry to have troubled you chaps. I don't know how you get along so fast in traffic on the roads these days." The end. So that's those. It's so very David Niven, you know.
And, so very British, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So that's Ian, and he's buried in England, where he's from, in Severhampton in Wiltshire in England. Interesting thing about Shirley Bassey. Okay, so she wrote "Diamonds Are Forever," or she sang "Diamonds Are Forever" and "Hey Big Spender" and "Goldfinger," and she was born in Cardiff, which is the same place Tom Jones is from in Wales. And she actually had a hit in the early 90s with a group called the Propellerheads, and it was called "History Repeating." And she said, "I didn't know anything about this stuff. I just did it for my grandkids." But interesting about Shirley Bassey is that she had a daughter, she's 21 years old, called Samantha, who fell to her death in Bristol, in England, over the Clifton Suspension Bridge. Now, I've been to Bristol many times, and this bridge is one of the most horrific high bridges. I mean, it is so scary to go up there. I mean, and also it's a popular suicide location. And I'm talking, it's major. Like, the cars look like little tiny, you know, things when they're going by. And they had to put a big thing over the cars going by because of the people jumping off the bridge.
Jeez.
And it was Shirley Bassey maintained that her daughter did not commit suicide, said that it was a murder. And
did someone threw her off the bridge?
Yes. But the police in various investigations, because the case was reopened another time, but they say they couldn't find any criminal activity. But Shirley Bassey maintains that there was an issue with an ex-boyfriend who, you know, and another person who was guilty of another murder. Mm. So Bassey was convinced, but the police said no, there was no criminal.
A lot of times with suicides, the family won't accept that that's what it was.
Yeah,
I think that's common. Yeah. And maybe she's right. Maybe she's correct that it was foul play. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because it's possible there was a legitimate theory. Mm-hmm. But sure. And also, yeah, there's a stigma that is attached to that. Sometimes families cut that part out. And then we have, you know, the other Bonds are still alive, you know, Pierce Brosnan and Timothy Dalton, who played him twice. And Daniel Craig, and I think those are the only ones.
There's right? six. There yeah, no... yeah. Oh, and then we yeah. talked about George Lazenby already. Yeah.
And Connery, and he's still alive. And more. Yeah.
Yep.
And I think that you just said Daniel Craig is a good choice for Bond. Did you see when they did they had the Olympics in Britain a couple of years ago, and the opening for the Olympics was him going to Buckingham Palace, and the Queen actually participated in it, which is something that would normally never happen, but he had her picking her up at Buckingham Palace, and she got into the helicopter and everything. And I have to watch that again. I don't know if it actually happened that way, but it appeared that the Queen was coming down in a parachute or something like that.
That's right. I remember about that. Yeah.
She did participate, which was pretty cool because it shows that she has the right advisors, you know, because it lightened her up for mm-hmm. another generation.
I have a friend who is a fitness trainer, and a lot of their clients are A-list actors that, you know, we don't realize that these action stars, they're oftentimes, you know, men in their 40s and 50s, and they're expected to have the physique of a 20-year-old professional athlete when mm-hmm. they're on screen. And you look at, you know, sometimes Leonardo DiCaprio get dragged because he gets, you know, photographed out in public between movies and he's got a bit of a paunch, you know, and they're like, oh, he's letting himself go. And it's like, yeah, because it's not normal for a middle-aged person to look like that all the time. And my friend made the point that, you know, Daniel Craig, when he has to be Bond, I mean, he's 52 now. And he got injured on the set of Spectre when he was doing that a few years ago. He injured his knee, and he got really mad because they went over budget or they went over schedule. And so he basically has to keep this crazy regimen up that is only humanly possible for a few months when it comes to the diet and the exercise in order to make yourself look the way that he looks on screen. And so if something goes overtime, it just makes that physical torture last even longer, and it increases the odds that they get injured doing stuff, which he was on Spectre. And then after that, he said he wasn't going to do another Bond. And then, you know, luckily he's done a couple more since then. But yeah, it did open my eyes to the kind of training regimens that these guys have to go through to look the way they do and the stress it puts on their bodies.
Yeah. Yeah, I was watching Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones, you know, and he, again, you know, to have that kind of ripped body to be, you know, older person, that's hard work. That is real. Yep. That's like 8 hours a day kind of exercise.
Yep. You know? And you just get injured more. I mean, you can get injured getting out of bed the wrong way, yeah. You know, at a certain point. So, yeah. Respect.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's wild when people go through those transformations for a movie. The guy that was in that Jurassic Park movie not that long ago was another one that was
Pratt. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Chris Pratt.
So, yeah.
And Kumail, who was in the Big Sick that he wrote with his wife and starred in, he's on Silicon Valley. He came out with some photos recently. He got super ripped for some role, and he put some Instagram photos out of it. And he said basically, like, this is not possible for most people. This is only possible because the studio gave me a trainer and a dietitian who turned me into this. He's like, I would not have been able to do this on my own, so don't think that this is any attainable standard for the average person to like hold them to, you know. I couldn't have done this by myself. So,
and that is literally torture. That is literally torture that these guys go through. But yep. they're well compensated, you know. I'm not going to say I wouldn't sign up for that, but you know, for 6 months of work to go into that, as long as with that kind of payoff, yeah, that'd be kind of nice.
I do that for 6 months for like $10 million.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I could do that. I could go on a vegetable
diet. And then I'd pull a George Lazenby. I'm like, okay, I'm good. I don't got to do that again.
Well, dine out on the I was the one James Bond story for the rest of your life. And you could.
Who's next?
Okay. Well, you know, I was just thinking we did all the Bonds. We acknowledged all the Bonds. So logically, where we go next. And again, it opens up a whole can of worms, the Bond girls. You know, because mm-hmm. there are so many, and it becomes confusing because some of the people that are considered Bond girls were actually villains, so they're not technically Bond girls. The Bond girls were like the love interest kind of one. So, mm-hmm. So again, I just figured we'd jump into a few that are interesting names, you know, people that have gone on, because there are a lot of ones that did the I was a Bond girl once, you know, and some of the people are more famous than the others.
Right.
Like Honor Blackman. Like Diana Rigg, who was I think it was the first time, and it was the Lazenby Bond that she was married to Bond. It's the only time that ever she played she played Tracy Bond, and it's the only time Bond was ever married was the was in the Lazenby mm-hmm. Bond, and that was on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Daniela Bianchi, she was Tatiana Romanova in From Russia with Love, still alive. Barbara Bach, who played Anya Amasova, Agent XXX, in The Spy Who Loved Me, married Ringo Starr in 1981. when they were in a movie called Caveman. In fact, Barbara Bach called James Bond afterwards a chauvinist pig because he would throw women in front of guns, you know, to save himself. You know, which makes sense.
Which is bad.
I mean, he is. Yeah. Yeah. One of the women that were in the movie, in one of the movies, Goldfinger, famously. Goldfinger seems to be, I think, the most iconic James Bond movie because mm-hmm. that's the one that so many characters came from. And she right. was the girl that was painted gold in the movie. Mm-hmm. And she ended up on the cover of Life in that famous pose where she was covered in this gold paint. And suppose mm-hmm. in the movie they were suffocating her because the skin can't breathe through gold paint. But it was but she was iconic, most definitely. Mm-hmm. And Jill Masterson was her name. And she retired from acting in 69. But she's still around. I see her around at the autograph shows. And another one that was it's interesting was Britt Eklund, who was a, you know, sort of a sex bomb in the 60s. And she was involved in a relationship with some fascinating people. She was involved with Peter Sellers. She was involved with Lou Adler. He had a son with Lou Adler. And she's on my radar because she is responsible for the Rocky Horror Picture Show because she saw it in London at the Royal Court Theater when it first premiered 6 weeks at the upstairs 60-seat theater. She saw it, and she brought Lou Adler to come and see it, said, "You got to see this." And he saw it, and he opened it here as a play in Sunset, on Sunset Boulevard, and ultimately co-produced the movie. But so Britt Eklund, who, you know, she's still around too, is, you know, largely responsible for the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So I think it's I always got to go there too. It's like Helter Skelter, Rocky Horror. And that's what I do. The other girls that are famous, Ursula Andress, who, you know, famously came out of the water with a knife, you know, and a bikini. Mm-hmm. And I met her one time too, and she called me a colossus.
How was that?
She said, "You're a colossus." Because I was, she did. She really did. I mean, I was, you know, we had a proper conversation. I was introduced. I mean, it wasn't like I was just, you know, grabbed her as she was walking by. But
you're a colossus. Yeah, that's a different context.
Yeah. So it was in a friendly setting, but anyway, Ursula Andress and Halle Berry recreated that scene, you know, when she was in the Bond movie too. So, and then you have the Bond villains. And you've got Charles Grey, another Rocky Horror reference, because he played Blofeld. Blofeld was a victim, or was a character that showed up in several Bond movies and was played by several actors. And the first couple of times, it was only by the back of his head and his hands and a dubbed over voice, like Charlie's Angels was. But then maybe where they got it from. And then Charles Grey played him. Died of a heart attack in London at the age of 71, and You Only Live Twice. And he also played him another person called Dico Henderson in another Diamonds Are Forever movie. But then they brought him back for Blofeld. Tali Savalas played Blofeld. Donald Pleasance in You Only Live Twice. Max von Sydow in Never Say Never Again. And the current one is a man by the name of Christopher Waltz. Now the characters aren't as iconic, or the actors aren't as iconic as you know. Because maybe that's just me.
Christoph Waltz is great, though. Christoph Waltz, I really like. Yeah, he's fantastic.
I know them as the characters when I go see the movie, but I would never, you know, recognize them. And that's not me. That's no judgment. That's just you know, the other ones, you know, honor.
Well, Christoph is famous for working with Tarantino. He was in Inglourious Basterds. He's the villain. And that's really what launched
his
pop culture stardom. That's Christoph. And then he's in Django.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I know him. Yeah. He was like the head of the Nazis, wasn't he?
Yes.
In Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, that,
okay.
Like,
I think he had a long career.
Yeah. He had a long career before that, but that launched him into like superstardom, I think, when he was in Inglourious Basterds. Because he was so fantastic in it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he won the Oscar that year for that movie. He was great. And Richard Kiel, who played Jaws, another Detroit man.
That's my Detroit. Yeah, that's my favorite Bond villain is Jaws.
Yeah,
because he was a villain, and you know he was a villain in two of the Roger Moore movies. He was in two movies, so he recurred. And I just love the giant guy with the metal teeth. Like, what a badass villain that is.
Yeah,
he was 7'2", and reportedly suffered from a fear of heights.
That wouldn't surprise me. You know, he's 7'2". He's 300 pounds or something like that, and not
when you fall,
out
it's
of
a
proportion.
Big deal.
Yeah, not out of proportion. He had a car accident, and he walked with a cane for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. And he was in the most, probably one of the most famous Twilight Zone episodes, you know, to serve man, where, you know, they land on this planet or whatever, the Martians, you know, ended up, spoiler alert, you know, the To Serve Man was actually, you know, a cookbook. And that's what he would sign. I had him sign a book for me once, and he wrote, "It's a cookbook." But he was, you know, he came up to me. I've got a picture of this. He came up to me and put his hands on my head, just like that. Just put his, I mean, it was like a basketball. And he just unannounced, just went and did that to me.
And you're a colossus.
Yeah. He was a colossus.
How tall are you, Scott?
I'm 6'2". So
yeah, he makes you. I remember. I think I've seen the photo. He made you look tiny.
Yeah, I mean, he was a super nice guy, but
You mentioned that he had been in a car wreck, and if he played the character Mr. Larson in Happy Gilmore. Remember, he's in the audience at the golf tournaments, and he's wearing a T-shirt that says "Guns don't kill people, I kill people." And
that's great.
What's interesting, if you watch that movie, in every shot he's in, he's either has a cane or he's leaning on somebody. For that reason, because he was unsteady on his feet for the rest of his life after that. Yeah,
and he wasn't disabled. You know, it was just a hormone thing. You know, he was perfectly able, you know, until that accident, and perfectly proportioned. So yeah, that was he was a big guy.
Have you heard about? I recently read, and I don't know if you can confirm this. He was originally cast as the Incredible Hulk.
No, I didn't know that. You know, the Hulk had to be a muscle man. You know, he had to be. Right. His shirt came off, and Keel wasn't that guy.
But yeah, he didn't seem like a big, strong, built guy. He was just very tall, bodybuilder. Just a large person. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and he just passed away. I think he was one of those people that had a double grave because he was so big. They had to buy a double grave and
make
a custom casket for him. Yeah, and he was born again too. He was saved after he became an alcoholic and he stopped drinking. He attributed it to his savior, and he actually died in September of 2014 of a heart attack. And yes, I forget how old he was.
He was 74.
74. So just a couple of weeks or a couple of days before his 75th birthday, I think.
Yeah.
So and other villains were, you know, there was Goldfinger. There was literally Goldfinger, who was the guy who played the king in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh, interesting.
And I think they dubbed his voice through the film because he could not speak English very well. His real name is Gert Frobe, was his name. And he died in September of 1988 of 75 of a heart attack.
Yeah, so there was Oddjob, who was played by an actor named Harold Sakata. In Goldfinger, and he was a wrestler and I believe a silver medalist, Olympic weightlifter. He was from Honolulu, Hawaii, and he was of, you know, Japanese descent and lived and died in Hawaii. He was also in an episode of Gilligan's Island. He was one of Rory Calhoun's henchmen, supposedly, on Gilligan's Island. Yeah.
He's a guy that took his role and went with it. Yeah, because that has been spoofed because he had the bowler hat that was lined in lead or whatever it was. And
razor blades or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and he would kill people with it. And then in the 60s, again, this is a reference, a time reference, there was a cough medicine called Formula 44. And he would cough, and every time he'd cough, it would be like a karate chop. Like some things would get destroyed all around him. And so, you know, so it was an iconic character, the Asian guy with the hat and the villain. And we're going to probably talk about this a little bit later, the Austin Powers movie, there was another actor named, his name was Joe Sun. And Joe Sun was Korean and also a wrestler. And Joe Sun is in prison now for murder. He killed somebody. He actually he participated and was found guilty in a gang rape, and then in prison he killed a cellmate and got 27 years for it.
That's who. Wait, who was this again?
His name was Joe Sun.
Yeah, like years ago.
Yeah. So apparently the woman that they had their way with said it's Christmas and this is your lucky day, and tortured her, and he was actually in prison. I guess the statute, I guess the statute of limitations for rape was over with, but they got him on torture. And and then while in prison, he was put in with a sexual abuser in prison, and he killed a cellmate, got another 27 years for that. So so the guy that's in the Austin Powers movie is the first one, international man of mystery, portraying the odd job, Harold
Scott.
Parody
character, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then Hervé Villechaize played with Roger Moore, Nick Knack was the character he played. And another villain. And Roger Moore hated his guts, actually. Hated Hervé Villechaize's guts. Said he was
Are there people that worked with Hervé that liked him?
Well, it's true. He said he was a sex maniac. He said, and that's well documented too. And he said that Roger Moore, he was so annoyed with him. And Roger Moore goes, how many women were you with since we started this movie? And he said 35. And that's including the ones he paid for, I guess. That's what he said. That's the quote from Roger Moore. So,
real quick, odd job. Harold Cicada died in July 29th, 1982 from liver cancer. He was 62 years old.
62 so. In Hawaii. Mm-hmm. God bless him. So, and Hervé, well-documented, committed suicide, tape recorded it. And I think we talked about this in a previous episode.
Yeah, we talked about him early.
Back to Honor Blackman. So she famously played Pussy Galore in Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
And insert joke here, was actually, they say, based on a real model from Romania named Livia Nasta. And she served in the Royal Air Force during World War II and had that nickname for some reason. this is the information I've gleaned. And she joined Special Operation dealing with Nazi control in World War II. And she married a spy. And her husband was close to Winston Churchill, who knew Ian Fleming. And so they say that, you know, Pussy Galore was, it sounds outrageous to say that was her nickname, and they took it for, but that would explain the really graphic, you know, it's a graphic name for, you know, a movie in the 60s. How they got away with that through the censors,
I think that back then it was probably still more commonly a term for cat. And it was just seen as a more harmless name than we probably see it as now, especially by the time, in England, I bet. Yeah.
But not Octopussy. Right. You know, by that time, it was like, come on. And maybe they got away with it because they said, oh, it's already an established character. You know, maybe that's how they got away with it. But I just find that fascinating. Miss Moneypenny. It was another standard character, and it was originally played by Lois Maxwell, who died in 2007 at the age of 80. And then Carolyn Bliss played Miss Moneypenny in the Timothy Dalton one. And the Samantha Bond, who actually I know her more so from Downton Abbey, and she played Crawley's sister. And then Naomi Harris. Yeah, yeah. The Crawley, the head of the family, the patriarch. That's his sister. Played her, and she is the one who, not Lady Mary. Who's the second one? The fair haired one.
I can't remember.
When she gets pregnant,
I know you're talking about.
She goes to this one. That's her aunt. This is kind of cool. The character Q, who's been played by a lot of different people over the years, was actually based on a man that Ian Fleming served in the military with, Charles Fraser Smith. He worked alongside Ian Fleming in WW2, and he invented things like flexible metal straws and hidden compasses and golf balls that were sent to prisoners in Germany. And so Ian Fleming took that sort of his knowledge of him and incorporated it into the James Bond novels that he eventually turned into these films. But as I understand it, the MI6, they would consult each other just to make sure the guys from Bond would invent something crazy, like, you know, I don't know what it was, you know, just guns and cufflinks and things like that, incorporate those, but they they kind of get in touch with the MI6 people and saying, what do you think of this? And they're saying, well, perhaps you might, you know, do something else or whatever. But it was so legitimate because it's actually based on someone that Fleming served in the military with.
And they just wanted to check with MI6 to make sure, hey, we're not getting too close to real life. We don't want to give away anything that you're really doing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think that the compasses and hidden maps and hairbrushes and things like that, I think those were legitimately used.
Wow.
And were probably incorporated into the Bond films, but he invented them in real life. So it's kind of cool.
And I do remember my grandfather was a POW at Stalag Luft 3 during World War II. Mm-hmm. And I do recall when researching that they would sometimes get in care packages, like some dice would actually be something you could be opened up and there'd be something in it, a message to the prisoners there, you know, from intelligence. So yeah,
there was one where he would write in a special kind of ink that wouldn't be visible to anyone unless you urinated on it. That would make it appear. So it was like, you know, secret decoder rings, kind of things like that.
Right.
So, yeah, fascinating man. Now here's a bit of trivia for you. And in the movie, License to Kill. The movie License to Kill came out in 1989, and that movie was used as the alibi for the Menendez murders. The boys claim they went to see License to Kill the night their parents were killed, and then the police were following up with it. Detectives are like, okay, can we see the stubs from the movie? Mm-hmm. And no, actually, we went to see Batman or something like that. But we watched it on TV. I don't know what it was exactly, but they did use License to Kill as an alibi the night they murdered their parents.
Unbelievable. And that's Timothy Dalton, right? I think License to Kill, yeah. Those were the Timothy Dalton ones were violent. I remember that. There was the one where the guy's head explodes in the pressurized like vault with like the little porthole window, and you see the guy's head go. Pfft. Yeah, it's really. I remember being as a kid being like shocked because the James Bond movies usually weren't like that. It was a little campier violence, I guess, or you know, more fun to watch. The Timothy Dalton ones really felt like serious, like R-rated,
gory
things. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. I don't remember those movies. I experience them and I walk away. Goldfinger is iconic, but the most of the others I kind of remember, you know, certain instances, you know, like Roger Moore on that funicular, but was the thing that's hanging and when he's skiing up in the Alps, and you know, I think that was Richard Kiel was one of those guys. And yeah, so
did
I
you ever play
scenes.
The GoldenEye video game?
No.
Not Golden a big gamer. Eye. You're not a big Golden Eye. It was I was in college when that came out, and that is one of those like video games that really changed video games forever because the first person shooter game, but it was really advanced graphics for its time, and the big thing was it had multiplayer on a version. You could be Odd Job in the multiplayer and run around and try to get each other. It would be four on a screen. You know, you'd have four different screens, up to four players, and that game totally changed. It was a rare instance where a game based on a movie was actually really, really good and not just a promotional thing. Yeah, it's a huge game.
In A View to a Kill, there was a character called Mayday, and she wasn't a bad person. I mean, she was a baddie, so calling her a Bond girl is technically wrong, but it was Grace Jones. And there's great action scenes with Grace Jones, and she's so iconic. She's so, you know, the way she looks is so incredibly iconic. Mm-hmm. I think, and I got another Grace Jones story if you want it. I don't think I told this one in the past, but a lot of these boiled down to my time in England, and you end up having drinks with Grace Jones, or we were supposed to have drinks with Grace Jones, and if Grace Jones is anything, it's on Grace time. You know what I mean? So we had an appointment to see her at like 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 10:30. She finally shows up. And so we're already half tanked, you know, and and she comes in. We talk a lot of small talk. You know, I talked to her about Pee-wee's Christmas special, because, again, it's one of my favorite episodes of television ever in history. And she was going on about how that was a magical experience working on that show. But anyway, so somehow it got to the term hermaphrodite, and you know, a hermaphrodite by definition is a person who was born with both female and male genitalia. Now there's a really famous rumor about someone who's well known for being in horror movies being someone like that, a hermaphrodite. Huh. And I mentioned that to her, and she said, well, people say that about me too. And I said, well, there's usually no smoke without fire. I had had a, and that's when she blew up. She said, bull fucking shit. And she got really pissed off at me for that, because, you know, she was just, we got her calmed down eventually, but she was really pissed off at me.
That you would even imply that that could be true?
Yeah.
Even jokingly, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she has, you know, she's traded on the sort of male, female gender, you know, in one of her songs, she talks, you know, feeling like a woman, looking like a man, you know, so there is a, you know, that came from one of her songs. So, you know, but yeah, bull fucking shit. She was pissed, but we ended up calming her down. And it was an ugly time with Grace. But anyway, and she played this character called May Day. And I think that's the last of my name dropping this episode. But my favorite will always be, one of my favorite celebrity stories is Roger Moore and the fart machine and the phony cappuccino.
Amazing.
And then the character of M, who, you know, Robert Brown, Ralph Fiennes, M. Bernard Lee, and currently, or most recently, I think Judi Dench played M in most of the movies. In the more recent movies.
That's right, yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
And they just recently reintroduced the Moneypenny character in the new movies as well.
When I was doing it, I thought, oh, wasn't Gwyneth Paltrow a Moneypenny? But that's Iron Man, and she plays the Moneypenny character.
She's kind of that already, yeah. Man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just one other thing, you asked about the name of the villain in Goldfinger.
So is that it?
You know what? There's so many flailing edges to this. But as far as, you know, my research went, and, you know, my favorite characters and stories all came out of this. So so it's no long, you know, it's certainly by no means a complete James Bond, but it's the ones we like.
Yes. Well, thanks again, everybody, for listening in. And for those of you watching on YouTube, because we're putting these episodes on YouTube now, and we're staying socially distanced from each other, doing these from our own homes still. And we're just going to keep doing that. It's actually kind of easy once we get over the technical aspect of it. but we're going to keep doing this. And thank you, everybody, for continuing to listen to us. And hit us up on Patreon should you feel so inclined. And also check us out on Scott's YouTube page, his Dearly Departed Tours YouTube
Dearly
page.
Departed. It's called Dearly Departed Online. And you can find it that way on YouTube. Look up Dearly Departed Podcast. You'll find it on YouTube as well. And when you get there, there's a little button to subscribe, and you'll be notified of our future podcasts being launched.
Yeah. And you have like 23,000 followers and growing, so that's really awesome. All right. So everybody, thanks again for listening in, and we will see you on the next one.
Thanks. Thanks, you guys.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.